The Saudi leadership should ever get our focus away from the tragedy and Saudi sharing responsibility on the tragedy unfolding in Yemen. So Yemenis really understand that they are, facing the disastrous foreign policy from Saudi Arabia that they have never seen before from their neighboring country.
Toby Jones, very quickly before we conclude, we have 20 seconds. Is there now a risk of a direct confrontation between Iran and Saudi Arabia?
They've failed, as Afra said, largely in their Yemen war. They'll neither mount a military campaign in Lebanon, although they may try to destabilize it internally, nor seek to confront Iran directly, though they sure would like others to do it for them, including the U.S.
Well, Toby Jones, we want to thank you for being with us, Director of Middle Eastern Studies at Rutgers University, joining us from Rutgers. And Afra Nasser, independent exiled Yemeni journalist, founder and editor-in-chief of the Sana'a Review. Congratulations on receiving your award from the Committee to Protect Journalists. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for our paid six-month internships. Go to our website for details. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And coming up, Voices from the Edge, our guests' hosts, Carrie and Amory. Welcome two guests for their show talking about the Native American Heritage Month. And that's coming up in just a couple of minutes on KBOO. At 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, Todd Davies is live in the studio with her updated food memoir and cult classic jam today. And at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, creative voices from Portland's stop-motion animation community talk about their work now on exhibit at the Portland Art Museum. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Outside the Frame's film screening of Leaving Home on Monday, November 13th at 6 p.m. at Portland Center Stage at the Armory in Portland. Outside the Frame will be hosting a special gala screening of new films by and with youth experiencing homelessness in Portland. The evening will also feature a Q&A with the filmmakers, and a Lifetime Achievement Award will be presented to Tia Plimpton to recognize her decades of work and mentorship with homeless youth. Again, that's Outside the Frame's film screening of Leaving Home on Monday, November 13th at 6 p.m. at Portland Center Stage at the Armory, 128 Northwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8:03 a.m. I'm Carrie Waters.
And I'm Amory Shack. You are listening to
Native Voices from the Edge.
And we have to reunite. I said better gather up our warriors, cause tonight is the big fight. Hey, 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 hey. Oh, 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 oh. Hey, 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 hey.
Here at Native Voices from the Edge, we are filling in for the entire month of November, bringing you unique perspectives from Native America and some of our friends to talk about the state of our city and region.
We're excited to bring you two interviews with community leaders in Portland today. The thread that ties them together into our show today involves connection to place and sense of belonging. Oftentimes we hear about EDI principles, DEI, or even worse, DIE. Equity, diversity, and inclusion are thrown around as concepts a lot these days, and oftentimes they turn into buzzwords, into icing on the cake rather than essential ingredients that fundamentally change the nature of the cake itself. Given this risk of equity washing, I see it fundamental to add a J before the EDI, JEDI principles. So, as we approach justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion work, we have to consider the fact that we are facing 500 plus years of interconnected systems of oppression. This past year, I've been grounding myself in the Just Transition Strategic Framework, which offers a holistic approach to our relationship to place and people as we consider transitioning to a clean energy economy, to the green path as opposed to the scorched path. I know that this framework was touched upon in September by a guest host, Joseph Santos Lyons, and it has been an inspiring strategic framework for me because it has a holistic grounding regarding the pillars of our economy. So earlier this year, I was reminded that the root word eco means home. So that means ecology means knowledge of home, and economy means management of home. Our current extractive economy digs, burns, and dumps resources. It exploits the labor towards the end of concentration of wealth and power. The worldview is grounded in colonization and consumerism and is enforced through militarism. So a just transition to a regenerative economy recognizes that we have a new normal in our lives here, in our society, in our planet, and that we will have to make a transition to a clean energy and green economy. However, a just transition is not necessarily going to take place unless we take action to make that so. So a just transition to a regenerative economy seeks regenerative interaction with resources, cooperative labor, towards the end of social and ecological well-being, under the worldview of caring and sacredness through a governance structure of deep democracy. So in this light, if a local jurisdiction wants to diversify its committees to fit them into the mold of dominant society, the status quo will reign supreme. Alternatively, that same jurisdiction can make the choice to reflect on its power structures and the way that it has always operated in order to create a new paradigm that not only better serves those that have experienced historical injustices, but that improves our society as a whole as a result of justice and equity-focused work at the core. Inclusion is another interesting concept. What does it truly mean to be inclusive? I think it doesn't mean that people of color should be, quote unquote, invited to the table more, but rather that we need to co-create a system of engagement grounded in building and sharing power.
I think that's a really good point. We have been talking about, Carrie and I have been talking about what it does mean to be inclusive and our own spaces that way, about how we've been invited into spaces and where we're sitting because of our own identities. Carrie, would you mind talking a little bit more about where you sit in communities, maybe talk about the work of NAIA a little bit?
Yeah, so I can just share about my lived and worked experience. I grew up here in the Portland urban Indian community, although my specific identities are rooted to Southeast Alaska as a Tlingit tribal member, as well as Eastern Europe and Norway and Russia. So, you know, I recognize that I myself have a certain level of privilege of being able to pass as white and yet not fully identifying in that way. So it's a tough balance to manage as we consider what it means to truly be inclusive. You know, I think another concept that we talk about a lot these days is what it means to create a safe space. And I don't think it's possible to create a fully safe space. However, you know, we can try to move in that direction so that people are comfortable with feeling vulnerable and, you know, not putting up a front like we have it all together, but so that we can actually delve into genuine conversations that cause self-reflection and invite reflection from all parties. So I think that's really important as we consider Jedi principles and what that looks like in our community itself. You know, there's a lot of amazing things going on in Portland, but we can't pretend like, you know, these issues of oppression and racism and all of these other systems don't still exist. They permeate our society.
Yeah. And there's so much work that has been done throughout history to alleviate that as well. And I think that's something that just when I think about place and belonging, just think about the work, you know, for generations, how Native nations have, either with the help of federal or state government, treated the symptoms of colonialism and having the ability to have sovereignty and for space for tribal lands. I think something we can talk about a little bit would be indigenous governance here, and to talk about, I'd like to read an excerpt from a book titled An Indigenous People's History of the United States by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And it's just a really good little excerpt on how work has been done to treat the symptoms of colonialism. In talking about indigenous self-determination movements in the second half of the 20th century.
Great.
So through this work, which would be with these symptoms of colonialism, we'll start right here. But with the powerful indigenous self-determination movements of the second half of the 20th century, nations participated in drafting and instituting new institutional international law that supports their aspirations, and they began working on shoring up the sovereignty through governance. Through this work, U.S. indigenous peoples have reconceptualized their current forms of government based on new constitutions that reflect their current specific cultures. Navajo thinking on a future constitution expressed that desire. Like some other Native nations, the Navajo, the most populous and the one holding the largest land base in the United States, has never had a constitution, but others do have constitutions similar to that of the United States. Nearly 60 Native nations adopted constitutions before 1934, and following the Indian Reorganization Act of that year, another 130 nations wrote constitutions according to federal guidelines without significant participation of their citizenry. So the movement to create, revise, or rewrite constitutions has seen notable success in two instances during the first decade of the 21st century. And just bringing that up as a way to just ground us too in the work of space and the work of belonging in place. And that's just one of many examples of how Indian or indigenous governance has been worked out for centuries.
That is so powerful and such a great reminder to us all about the unique political status of tribes throughout the United States. Mm-hmm. So while not all tribes are recognized by the federal government or even by state governments as sovereign tribal nations, they are inherently sovereign and have that ability to self-govern and self-determine their own future. So that's an important distinction to make because oftentimes when we raise issues related to tribal sovereignty and, you know, rights to land and resources, oftentimes people might see this as, you know, a special interest group or mm-hmm. grounded in race rather than political status. And so here within the Portland urban Indian community, you know, we are almost 60,000 total, but we come from many diverse backgrounds and heritages. Many of us are mixed. And so, you know, that's important to recognize as well, that, you know, there were specific policies back in the 1950s with termination. So, you know, you referenced the Indian Reorganization Act, which helped to establish constitutions and acknowledge the inherent tribal sovereignty of tribal nations. But a lot of those rights were severed for many tribes who were terminated of that status and were relocated to urban areas, including Portland, which was one of the designated relocation hubs. So there are many reasons that have brought our community members to this space here. And so we have a unique opportunity in this space to both come together, you know, as a diverse tribal community, but also, you know, to look to those who have lived here since time immemorial. So looking to those that have either called this place home historically, or, you know, that have used these grounds as usual and accustomed areas for harvest, for hunting, for gathering. You know, we have a duty here within the urban area to help make sure that those resources persist. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was having an interesting conversation about this with some folks this past weekend, and, you know, it reminded me of the Bolt decision, which happened up in Washington state for the tribes up there. And in the 1960s, Judge Bolt made this decision following the fish wars that happened earlier in that decade, and interpreted the treaty rights to ensure that there would be half of the catch going towards Native peoples. So that was a powerful use. We know that, you know, promises have been broken through the treaties. However, the treaties are a crucial tool for ensuring rights today. Earlier in the early 2000s, there was another case called Bolt 2, or the Culvert case, which recognized that it's fine and well if we say that natives can have half the catch, but if there's no catch to be had, that really doesn't do any good. So, you know, I think that's the line of thinking that I want to keep in mind for us here in the urban area. You know, we love our land use planning here in Oregon. And we should keep in mind tribal sovereignty as a core value of our planning throughout the state, so we can keep in mind, you know, the resources that have historically been in this place. So that's why, you know, moving towards this regenerative economy is so inspiring to me. You know, it's taking a step beyond sustainable. You know, we can sustain what we have right now, or we can take it a step further and leave this place better than we found it, through regenerative grounding of land engagement. So, you know, another concept that comes to mind is the distinction between space and time. So, as Native peoples, we've historically grounded ourselves in our connection to the landscape. So that's something powerful to keep in mind, is that, you know, we don't justify our existence based on, you know, having been here since 1832 or, you know, something along those lines, which I've heard from some folks who, you know, are really proud of the fact that they're, you know, third generation Oregonians or this and that. But really, you know, what is your connection to this landscape? That's great if you've been here for that long, but what does that actually mean in terms of your relationship to the plant world, to the natural world, and that relation to space? So I don't want to, you know, dismiss that connection that some folks have, but I would offer that they keep in mind the fact that many have lived here since time immemorial and don't justify their existence based on, you know, being present for generations, but rather have that inherent connection to land and to the space around us.
Right. So that's a great point, and thank you for bringing that up, Carrie. I think this would be a good time to transition and to talk about and think about the work being done in our communities right now, and talk about a little bit more about our next interview. So I'm going to introduce Cameron Witten, who is here with us today. Cameron Witten is the new East Portland Action Plan Advocate. EPAP is a movement for acknowledging community strengths and addressing challenges facing East Portland. Alongside that, his work includes serving as the executive director of a local nonprofit in New York City, and former executive director, correct. And he wears many hats in community activism, as well as just can tell you more about that. But his zeal for community betterment is a product of a life of struggle, survival, and a hope for his communities. So welcome. And I have a just first question. I'm curious if you can tell us a little bit about what you've learned so far in your new role with the East Portland Action Plan. I feel like it's been
2 months.
2 months. Okay.
They haven't fired me yet. So good morning, everybody. Thank you for having me on your show this morning. It's an honor to be here. And what a great bike ride in the rain. Getting in touch with that nature is what I did. That's why I'm so late. That's why I'm fashionably late. I'm sorry, K-Boo. So what I've learned in my first two, how is this mic? My first 2 months of work with the East Portland Action Plan, and I really think that the first takeaway is that there is work to be done. Mm. You know, East Portland Action Plan has been around for almost a decade, and it's been amazing to see the kind of successes that they've had. But it also highlights the horizon of work that needs to be done to make sure that East Portland has the equity and parity that it needs to have equity. You know, I think it's just interesting because we're talking about equity at its core. Because East Portland, you know, has 20% of the city's landmass, but then 30% of the population, you know, 40% of our youth are there, you know, overrepresentation of, you know, immigrant refugee people, people of color, low-income people. So if we're talking about real equity, realized equity in the city, if you can't start with East Portland, if you can't show what you've done in East Portland, you're going to have a lot of difficulty showing you've done work anywhere.
Right. And, I mean, there's a statistic that... although 25% of the population lives in East Portland, yet receives a disproportionately small share of the city's resources. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe talk about a little bit more about what resources are lacking in East Portland, or maybe talk about your experience either living or working in East Portland?
Well, name one and it's there. You know, transportation, you know, some of the highest crash corridors are there. Lack of public affordable housing. You know, a lot of people think East Portland has cheap housing, but as we're seeing the, you know, amount of gentrification happening, you know, in other parts of the city, it's also happening in East Portland. And we don't have public housing whatsoever to house people who might be facing rent increases. So we're losing people all the time. You know, economics. So, you know, what kind of living wage jobs do we have? Transportation. You know, how do we get them to these jobs? We do a lot of great, you know, east to west bus service, but north to south, not really. And East Portland, you know, if we're trying to get anywhere, Columbia Corridor, anywhere, the transportation is not there. Education, you know, closest higher education that we have is Mount Hood Community College, not in East Portland. You know, west of there, you know, a lot of private schools. So there's just a lot of lack of investment. And, you know, for folks who don't know, you know, East Portland was incorporated, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s. So much later after this, the rest of the city, and was considered to be suburban. That's changed now. It's very much urbanized. And so it was never meant to be these things, but now the community is living there and the community needs. And so we have to make a plan to serve them.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
So maybe if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about current projects or anything that is moving right now in a positive direction. If you wanted to talk about Gateway Green or talk about just what's next, what's exciting on the horizon.
Sure. Well, Gateway Green is technically not in East Portland. East Portland has everybody's learning so many things. So I know. That's the thing people don't know about East Portland is that there is a technical boundary, which is 13 neighborhoods that are a part of the East Portland Neighborhood Office area. So you have like 7 districts. You have, Southeast Uplift, Northeast Coalition Neighborhoods, Sweeney, Northwest Neighbors, What Inc., whatever. There's so many of them. And so East Portland is technically boundaried by 13 neighborhoods in the East Portland Neighborhood Office. And so my main role with East Portland Action Plan is actually giving out that money. And so, we're funded by the city, but half the money that is given distributed by the city, we actually give back into community to help push our plan forward. So, East Portland Action Plan, it was never, designed to be a place for someone like me to get a job or for us to become, institutionalized. Mm-hmm. We're really talking about being a catalyst for community-driven work. And so half of the money that's distributed by the city is actually funneled into community projects. And so I manage the grants program for that. And so it's interesting because I had to field a lot of these calls where people were like, oh, I have this thing on 167th and Halsey. And I'm like, that's not East Portland. Oh, I have this thing at Harrison Park, which is like 90th and Division. Not East Portland. And so you have to look at the neighborhoods. If it's not in one of those 13 neighborhoods, it is not a part of East Portland. So, yeah.
That's good to know. Okay.
And now you know.
I live in East Portland, so I should know that.
Where?
A little better. Park Rose Heights.
There you go. Yes, you live in East Portland.
Yeah, I was like, oh, I've been there, but great. Well,
One thing I wanted to say was that last night they actually had an East Portland City Council session. Okay. And that's been the first time, I think, since 2009. So it's been almost a decade. But it was great turnout. They had people testify for Division Midway Alliance, Apano. There were at least 2 people who testified from the East Portland Action Plan. They talked about many things, safety on Division, concerns about the bus rapid transit happening. One of the big issues that came up was the Gateway Education and Economic Development Center, and so that's something that has been promised. It's, I believe, in the Portland plan. Nothing's been done, so they're trying to convert the parking space. So it's if anybody's been to the Gateway Transit Center, it's a sea of parking lots, and they want to convert that into a regional economic development center so that you can get workforce training and micro enterprises and support the regional economy, specifically East Portland. And so there were other things they talked about, anti-displacement, gentrification, and many other things that could go on forever.
I was present for the proclamation for Native American Heritage Month yesterday morning at the morning city council meeting in City Hall. And now I'm thinking, because we heard back from some community members who said, oh, that's tough for me to get in, during the work day. But it didn't occur to me that this meeting was happening out in East Portland.
Yeah.
And that would have been a fantastic venue for a community celebration in the evening for this proclamation. So put that on the back burner.
More evening sessions. It's needed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. How did that come to be? Do you know the story?
It's probably planned way before me, but it was a long time coming.
That's great. Mm-hmm. That's great.
So we're coming up to the end of our time, but I wanted to ask you one more question just to ground us a little bit. Wanted to ask just what would you say to an aspiring ally, maybe someone who wants to get more grounded in racial justice, wants to get more grounded in working to support the neighborhood that they live in, even.
Well, I did bring you all a little gift. Oh. This is something that I posted on Facebook a couple of weeks ago.
Fantastic.
And so, if I have a white ally who asks me that question, what I just handed these two here is this invoice that I created. It has my picture on it. It's kind of like a meme. And it says, I've had to pay a lot for my life experiences. Support your friends of color. Racial advice should not be free and on demand. Mm. And so I think for allies, they need to pay up because there are a lot of people who put their lives and livelihoods on the line. And there are people who, if they want to learn from these people and want to commit to realized justice, need to pay it forward and to recognize the sacrifices of others. And so we need to be thinking about how to give life to our activist movement. And we can't do that by expecting people to, you know, work for nothing, not be appreciated, and continue this cycle of exploitation. Mm-hmm. If we were talking about envisioning a world where everybody prospers, those visionaries need to prosper as well. Mm. So that's my first response, pay up.
I love that. And I love that you said give life to it, you know. I could wait for that. Mm-hmm. Well, we are at our time, so we're going to do a little transition. Thank you so much for being here, Cameron.
Thank you.
I appreciate your time,
Cameron. Of course.
These wild days were united in praise. Sat down, I listened to our elders' wisdom, her stories and praise of the warriors that stayed behind. Things for the time which we take, a breath for the road my people take, the symbol of the sun, we travel, we won, connected to the earth, the seven generations, warriors of the future, giving rebirth for the people of the future, we stand up and fight, we fight for what's right, we pray to manifest our dreams from the sleepless nights, this is our life, this is our light, our land intertwines with our mind, it's our sacred right to protect and care. And share the insight to the stars with the beat of a drum to shatter the pain which is holding in our hearts under this hot new sun. My people in New Max, my people in AZ, my people who've been fighting just to be free. We live once again, united with my pen, connected like a web. We led, we bled, we laughed and cried, tied to the ways of our ancient past. My people live through me, therefore they'll never truly die. I scream to echo out in the night sky, it seems. In the minds of a youth, the fire's being born anew. To all my relations, relations, relations. To all my relations, relations, relations. To all my reservations, to all my nations. This is how we walk our life. These wild days we united and prayed, sat down and listened to our elders' wisdom, her stories and praise of the warriors that stayed behind, giving thanks for the time which we take, a breath for the road my people take, the symbol of the sun, we tribal, we won, we won, we won, we tribal, we won, we won, we won, we tribal, we won. To all my relations, relations, relations. To all my relations, relations, relations. To all my reservations, to all my nations. This is how we walk our life. To all our nations, red nations, red nations. To all my nations, all nations, all nations. This is how we live our life, yo.
Our next guest joins us by phone. Christine Bruno is a Comanche tribal member and is the president of the National Indian Parent Information Center. NIPIC's mission is to strengthen our community through support, education, and encouragement for families whose Native American tribal children ages birth to 26 are experiencing disabilities or learning challenges. I've known Christine for most of my life. I was in salmon camp with her son way back when, and this was a formative time for me as a youth to connect to my cultural grounding as a Tlingit tribal member of Salmon Nation, our bioregion that is tied together by Pacific salmon as a keystone species from California to Alaska. It's been an honor to continue to know Chris throughout my adult life, and I continue to be inspired by her commitment to culture, a connected fabric of the natural and built environment, and inclusion of those with disabilities or different abilities. Chris, I'm so glad you could join us by phone.
Thank you, Carrie. I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. Well, we're glad to have you. So please could you start by sharing a bit about yourself and the National Indian Parent Information Center?
So this is something that has came to our family. It's not something, sometimes people are like, wow, glad you figured out you wanted to do this and help other people. Well, to be honest, we were also helping ourselves. So it came out of a myself and my husband. So I'll just introduce a little bit about myself. My husband and I were both born and raised in Oregon. I lived up toward Mount Hood, Sandy area, and my husband in Warm Spring. And then we've been together since we were 18. And we then, in marriage, started a family. And then a few years after starting a family, we realized our oldest son was not learning typically, you know, as was expected by the broader society. And so it took quite a while, but when he was 8 years old, he was diagnosed as having autism. Hmm. And that started this whole journey that we've been on. And then National Indian Parent Information Center grew out of a local effort known as NAS, Native American Parent Support. That was a grassroots effort, and that began because Clifton and I was sitting with another couple who has a son, also with autism, the Edmo family, Carol and Ed Edmo and their son John, and we're saying, you know, we go to these workshops and different activities for families who have kids with autism or other types of challenges, and we rarely see anybody else from the Native American community at these. And we know other people have these challenges and need support, but they're not coming. And so why are they not coming? Yeah. Why are we the only ones time and time again at these different things in the area and workshops for parents and so forth or activities for the kids? And so then we just kind of brainstormed about all the barriers. Transportation, cost. A lot of these things do have a cost to them. Or if they have options for parents to attend free, you have to go through an application process to get a scholarship. You know, there's another layer to it and kind of a level of, it could be kind of humiliating, you know. Mm-hmm. Like you have to disclose why you need a scholarship, you know. Right. And that's not always easy for someone to do. It's like, I got to tell my story, really? Mm. So, and then often there's not childcare included mm-hmm. at these different workshops and so forth, so you're on your own to find childcare. If you can find it, it could be expensive. So, you know, just all these layers. And then there's just the issues of getting to these things and feeding your kids dinner or lunch or breakfast or whatever you have to do, and then having to maybe stop by and grab fast food on the way. There's another expense, and it's not very healthy either. So we just looked at all these things, and then we brought it to a meeting with other programs that was already occurring. Noreen Smoky Smith started having these Native Youth Networking meetings where people would get together and from the various organizations that work with Native youth in the Portland area. And then we brought it to them saying, hey, we want to do something. Mm. So that was kind of how it started. And that was in 2003.
That's so powerful. And I love the connection that you've made to incorporate culture and connection with the natural world as a core element of what you do. So I'm curious if you could please share with us, what is Quest into Nature?
So that is one of our newest things we're doing. Our program has done a lot of different things, or it's an organization. And let me be clear, it's a very small organization. You know, we don't have a huge office space and a lot of staff. It's primarily currently run via volunteers, primarily. And occasionally there is a little funding to pay some people's stipends. So just so you know, even though we have mm-hmm. been all over the country with workshops on special education and autism and so forth, we're very small organization. So because we moved our main office here to the Portland area when I took over, it used to be in Southern Oregon down in Grants Pass, people in the community were saying, hey, you should do some stuff within our community. We have a significant population in the Portland metropolitan area of Native Americans and therefore Native Americans who have children and family members with various types of special needs and challenges. You know, can you do some things? We need some things besides a workshop on how to navigate an IEP and things. We want things our family can come to and enjoy. And one of the things that I personally value highly is our natural world. The, you know, everything from the water, the trees, the plants, the animals, and the importance of having a connection to that.
That's great. Could you share the creation story of this partnership with Johnson Creek Watershed Council?
So there's an organization, kind of how Questions to Nature started, was we as in myself and my husband Clifton, who is a Wasco tribal member, so he's indigenous to right here in Oregon since time immemorial. And we were invited to start attending some and be a part of what's known as NACAC, Native American Community Advisory Council, which originally started primarily with Portland Parks and Recreation. But now there's other organizations that are attending that besides Portland Parks and Recreation and trying to bring about awareness to how we can manage our lands with traditional ecological knowledge, tech as it's known, and how we can have access to lands and to be able to do traditional gathering possibly, or even just to use parks. Like, for example, the parks have a no smoking policy. So they said, well, what about if people want to smudge? I mean, technically there is something smoking when you're smudging, even though you're not inhaling it via like a cigarette or a pipe. You know, can we smudge? And, you know, coming up with ways that we can work with parks to allow traditions to continue and within the rules that they have. And that's, you know, then we're saying there'd be all these things going on, and I'd be aware of different programs and tree plantings, you know, via this group of people. And I knew that I would like to participate in that. I would like families with kids with different challenges to participate, but they often don't because it's hard. You know, when you have a child who may have a behavior problem, or maybe they need some help with mobility, or they don't always get all the instructions right away.
Right.
You know, how can I make this accessible to everybody?
That's great. So how long has this partnership been in place, and what has that looked like over time?
So we're in our second year of having a grant to do some programming, and I got to give really a lot of credit to Jessica Rojas. She worked with the Quist Grants, the community watershed program here locally, she was encouraging at NACAC meeting, she was encouraging people to, hey, let's apply for some of these grants and have some things going on. And various people applied for some community garden work and, you know, different types of things. And I'm like, well, maybe I could do some events around trying to connect people to nature, get them outside, have them learn some things about the environment, hopefully learn about the importance of, it's all about, with this grant, it's how what are we going to do to improve ways to get water into the soil rather than running off of hard surfaces and down into the sewer system. So I had to work within that framework. And so we went ahead and had several meetings with Jessica Rojas, and she really was helpful to help me understand the whole process. But the thing is, I needed a partner. because I had, because I don't own property within the city of Portland to do this work personally, so I needed to have a partner. Mm-hmm. And it took a little while to figure it out, but we then were recommended to contact the Johnson Creek Watershed Council. Mm-hmm. And they said, yeah, you know, let's do this. And so they have been extremely supportive of the whole process. They are involved from, you know, the supporting me with the grant, writing the grant, all the way to being there the day of events with equipment. When I originally started this, I thought I was going to have to purchase a storage unit and have to purchase all kinds of tools, you know, shovels and rakes and so forth, and to then have a way to store all this equipment, then haul the equipment. Well, they already have all that.
Mm, perfect.
Yeah, so I did not have to purchase those things. I don't have to store those things, and I don't have to haul those things. So that took a huge burden off of me. They also, to simplify my life, which I really appreciated, they are our fiscal sponsor, mm-hmm. and we can be under their insurance for the event. So that takes also a level of burden off of us, our own resources and time and so forth.
Absolutely. I love, you know, this trend that I've been seeing in a positive way through partnerships, both, you know, with funders and just with partners that agree to come on board to support those of us that don't have those resources so that we don't have to duplicate existing processes, reinvent the wheel, so to speak, but that we can identify mutually reinforcing activities. You know, we know how to best engage with our community, so we can offer that up and partner with folks like the Johnson Creek Watershed Council and others who have resources that can support us in our self-determined vision.
Mm-hmm.
So that's powerful.
And then once we started working with Johnson Creek Watershed Council, we found we were going to wind up with an additional partner, because the sites that we are using are within Portland Parks and Recreation properties.
Mm.
And so we also are partnering with them, and they also bring equipment and tools. You know, when we get the native plants to do the plantings, they're the ones ordering them. You know, I don't, and they, because they know what they need for their site. So that's additional support and to do this project. It's a little tricky sometimes to schedule our events, because we have to have three organizations that are all available on the same day. But it's worth it, definitely worth it to collaborate with these two other organizations to do these events.
That's great. I'm glad that you mentioned the Native American Community Advisory Council to Portland Parks and Recreation. I found that to be such a crucial venue for information sharing and for community members to give wisdom and advice to Portland Parks and Recreation and other jurisdictions at the table, like Metro, so that they can better understand how to engage with our community and move forward a vision for our parks and natural areas. I'm so excited for the Botanic Specialist 1 position, which will support the Native Gathering Gardens model across the city of Portland. Chris, I'm curious, what excites you most about this position?
Just having someone that will have the knowledge and the time devoted of their workday to work on, you know, the traditional plants, to if they don't already know, hopefully they'll have some knowledge already about the importance of the varied plants in the area, our native plants, and the ones that are important for us culturally. I'm very excited about that. And hopefully, you know, this, our project, the barriers that we kind of took out of the way with us, this project, is there's no age limit. Everybody can come. The whole family can come. Friends can come. You can come if you're just interested. You don't have to have a child or an adult in your family with special needs to come. We have extra support there for those who need it, but not everybody needs the support, and it's fine for everyone to come do this together.
That's great. I'm also curious about the balance and your insights on the balance that we should find between cultural preservation versus cultural sharing. So knowing that the folks listening to this radio show right now are diverse, hopefully we've got some Native community members out there listening, but I'm sure many are not. And, you know, as we move forward, the tribal vision for this region and our landscape around us and our ecological system, you know, there's some knowledge that should be protected and other knowledge that is helpful to share out to the broader public. So I'm curious if you have any reflections on how to find that balance and any advice to folks who might want to support with this vision as non-natives, as to how they should approach that delicate topic.
Well, it's a very important topic. You know, we first of all have spoken with elders who are experts in our local ethnobotany plants. And there are some plants that are extremely important to us culturally, but they're plants that are not common plants. The plants that have to be collected very, very carefully. And we do not share anything about those plants to the general public, and even to necessarily, you know, some of that is kept within a very small group of people knowing. The traditional healers know that, and maybe a couple apprentices know this, you know, very small. But then there's other plants, and I'll give one example is the fireweed plant. Fireweed grows fairly prolifically from high elevations down to the valley floor. And so it's a more common plant, and so that's a plant that you can share with others about. It's also a really safe plant. The leaves can be made into a tea that can be drank in, you know, just for like we drink other teas, mint tea and so forth. It has some healing properties, but it also is just nice tea to drink. And so that's a plant that we can share. I know that the commonly people share about the properties of Douglas fir also, the fir tips. Mm. Again, it's a plant that grows, you know, all around us. And so that's something that you can share.
That's powerful. Thank you so much. So as we wrap up, is there any information that folks should know right now about the Quest into Nature events coming up within this next week? Or is there somewhere that they should go or could go to find more information?
Well, they're very welcome to contact the National Indian Parent Information Center, which would be contacting me via our Facebook page. We also have our phone number, 541-244-1822, and that is on our flyers, which are posted on Facebook, and or our email, info@nipic.org. So you can contact us any of those ways for questions.
Perfect.
About this, but you know, everybody's welcome. And then in the spring we'll have our third event, which will be taking a walk through this area at Powell Butte, and hopefully we'll be seeing all these flowers that we planted this in November in full bloom in April and learn about their uses and traditions around them.
Fabulous. Well, that'll wrap up our interview now. So thank you so much for joining us by phone, Chris, and taking the time to share out about this very important work.
Thank you for having me on, Carrie. I really appreciate that. And blessings to everyone out there for a great day.
Awesome. I hope you have a great day as well. Okay, well, we'll be in touch. So again, you've been listening to Christine Bruno of the National Indian Parent Information Center, speaking with us about her work to provide culturally enriched, inclusive outdoor fun for all ages. The Quest into Nature wildflower plantings take place at Powell Butte Nature Park on this Saturday, November 11th from 1 to 4 p.m., and Tuesday, November 14th from 4 to 6 p.m. More info can be found on the NIPIC, National Indian Parent Information Center, Facebook page. So we've highlighted one of many amazing events that are happening this month. November is always so busy for our people. Also taking place, we have a Native craft fair that's happening this Saturday. It's a bit earlier in the day than the Quest into Nature event, as it's happening from 10 to 3 at Wilshire United Methodist Native American Fellowship at 3917 Northeast Shaver Street. This event is open to the public, refreshments are available, and prizes are doled out every hour. Must be present to win.
And next Tuesday, Lewis and Clark Law School's Native American Law Students Association presents their annual fundraiser, a bingo night. This is a fundraiser for students to attend the Federal Bar Association's Indian Law Conference in the spring. And they will serve Indian tacos featuring fry bread made by a NALSA student. And we'll play a few rounds of bingos for prizes donated by local businesses around Portland. So come for the fry bread, stay for the prizes. And this event will take place from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Lewis and Clark Law School, which is at 10015 Southwest Terwilliger Boulevard.
On November 15th, Living Cully, a neighborhood initiative to redefine sustainability as an anti-poverty strategy, and the Cully Housing Action Team are hosting an event called Normandy and Renters' Rights, Learn from the Past, Fight for the Future. This free community event happens at Rigler Elementary School at 5401 Northeast Prescott Street from 5 to 7:15 p.m. If you live in the Cully neighborhood or are interested in standing in solidarity with Cully neighbors, join in to learn and take action for a new renters' rights policy. Homemade tamales, music, and kids' activities are in the cafeteria from 5 to 6, with the workshop to follow from 6 to 7:15 in the auditorium.
And as part of Healing Feathers Native Wellness Week at the Native American Student and Community Center, Indigenous artists of all disciplines, writers, musicians, visual artists, filmmakers, traditional arts, storytellers, makers, and crafters are welcome to join the NASCC to briefly discuss your work and network with the community. On Monday from 3 to 6 p.m., Staying Sacred takes place regarding conversations about missing and murdered Indigenous women. On Tuesday, Seed to Soil talks about harnessing the healing power of First Foods from 3 to 5 p.m. And on Wednesday, workshops take place from 12 to 4 p.m. So you can learn about tea and salves, natural cleaning, and basket weaving. And on Thursday, the focus is healing bodies, healing minds. Wellness walks and lunch take place from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., and the Indigenous Arts Collective Network meets from 5 to 7 p.m. And on Friday, socialize at a beading workshop from 9 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
So there's many more events that are happening. These are just a few. Mm-hmm. Amory, do you have any thoughts or advice for non-Natives interested in celebrating Native American Heritage Month?
Yeah, I would just say check in to see if the spaces mentioned are culturally specific or open to the public at large. I think that you could probably find the information out in each event's description. Just good context.
Perfect. That's mm-hmm. great.
Thanks to all of our listeners for joining us for our second edition of
Native Voices from the Edge.
Hey, hey, hey. Oh, oh, oh. Whoa. We are all one people and we have to reunite. I say better gather up our warriors, cause tonight is the big fight. Hey, 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 hey.
We'll be back next week with more perspectives and unique takes on issues relevant to our community. I'm Carrie Waters.
And I'm Amory Shack. Our engineer is John Shack. Thank you, John. Now stay tuned for Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights.
Good morning. It's 8:58, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. It's Press Watch next with Teresa Mitchell. The news you're not supposed to know at 10, Flashpoints, Investigative News Radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, Todd Davies is live in the studio with her updated food memoir and cult classic, Jam, today. At 11:30 on Words and Pictures, creative voices from Portland's stop-motion animation community talk about their work now on exhibit at the Portland Art Museum. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Robin Jackson Portland album release with The Call-In Trio on November 11th at 9 p.m. at the Secret Society in Portland. Award-winning singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist Robin Jackson is releasing his second solo record that draws upon the moody spirit of his rain-soaked Portland home to create an eclectic brew of dreamy folk pop, cinematic indie rock, and enigmatic storytelling. The Call-In Trio will also be featured. Again, that's the Robin Jackson Portland album release with The Call-In Trio on November 11th at 9 p.m. at the Secret Society, 116 Northeast Russell Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the second annual Know Your City Gala, Untold Stories, on Thursday, November 16th at 5:30 p.m. at the EcoTrust Event Space in Portland. Untold Stories is Know Your City's second annual benefit gala, and it raises essential funds to further Know Your City's programs of engaging everyday Oregonians in the history, culture, and civics of the region. This year's gala will bring together over 150 guests for an unforgettable evening, including hors d'oeuvres, drinks, dessert, performances from local talent, and a paddle raise. Again, that's the second annual Know Your City Gala, Untold Stories, on Thursday, November 16th at 5:30 p.m. at the EcoTrust Event Space, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue, Suite 200 in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.